Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about schedulers, going from our very simple or very theoretical schedulers. So we had our simple schedulers like first come, first serve and round robin, and our theoretical shortest remaining time first scheduler, to more practical schedulers. We looked at a way of approximating shortest remaining time first based on priority queues. Yes? It is on, but apparently not even close to loud enough. Okay. Let's see if we'll use the other mic. Okay. So, yeah, we were talking about approximating shortest remaining time first, with priority scheduling, setting our priority based on an estimate of remaining time. We estimated remaining time based on past behavior. We saw this multi-level feedback queue was what we called the resulting system. We also looked at schedulers that dealt with fairness. And we have this general idea of this proportional share, where we might assign fairness as not equal weights, but people get some more or less configured by, say, a system administrator. We saw we could implement that with a lottery scheme and also with something like what the Linux Completely Fair Scheduler did, where we track this notion of virtual time. We could weight that virtual time to adjust how much importance one program got over another, where this importance was sort of a factor for how much CPU time you get rather than a you get everything if you're more important, we saw with priority scheduling. And we also looked at an issue with fairness about whether we count for time that you're not runnable. And we saw the Linux Completely Fair Scheduler had a strategy where it gave some amount of credit for not being runnable. So if you were occasionally not runnable, you'd still get your normal share of CPU time as if you were. But if you had long waits, you wouldn't get too much credit for those, which would cause starvation. So those are schedulers we talked about last time. So questions about anything from last time? So there's one type of scheduler we didn't talk about that I want to just mention, which is that one problem you might have is you might have deadlines. So an example of this is if, like, you have the computer that's controlling the brakes in a car, it's really important that the thread that decides what signals to send to the brakes sends that signal by a certain deadline, or else things will go wrong. And the scheduler you want for that are, so one example would be something like earliest deadline first. So priority scheduler, your priorities are based on what those deadlines are, or there's some variance on that. We're not going to talk much about how they work, but I want you to be aware that if you have that sort of situation, you shouldn't just use a normal scheduler. It's not good enough. And it doesn't solve the right problem. So that's where I'm going to conclude talking about scheduling, and we're going to talk about threading. And to talk about multiple threads, we talked about scheduling threads, but we didn't really talk about why we would have multiple threads. And we're going to, in particular, look at multiple threads that are all somehow doing one task together. And there's two sorts of ways we'll think about that. So one is what we'll call concurrency, where we have two different things happening at once that are related in some way. Like, we have a web server, multiple users are contacting the web server, and maybe the web server has one thread for each user, so it can service the multiple users at once. But what those threads do is not necessarily extremely related. They might share some stuff, like if we're both accessing the same web page, maybe those two threads are accessing the same data. But they aren't sort of in lockstep. They're doing conceptually independent tasks that happen to have some shared stuff. or web browser. We might have a separate thread for each page in the web browser. They need to interact somehow, but most of what they're doing is independent. Or like we might have, say, a game where we might have one thread that's playing audio and one thread that's reading like keyboard input. They're working together, but they're not all doing the same task. So this is what we'll call concurrency. So different parts of the same overall application that are divided up and need to happen at the same time. There's also what we'll call parallelism, which is that I have one thing to do, one single task, but I want to use more resources to do it. In particular with threads, I probably want to use more processor time to do it than I could get with one core. So to take advantage of that, I'm going to split up the task into multiple pieces, even though it's this one big task. We're going to have an assignment doing a simulation where we'll have one simulation, and you're going to take a single-threaded version and make it multi-threaded with the goal that the multi-threaded version is faster, assuming you have multiple cores. So questions about concurrency and parallelism. So we're going to talk about how threads work. And we just talked about like scheduling threads. And we sort of gave the impression that the kernel is keeping track of all the threads and deciding which ones run with one scheduler. And this is the most common model, what I'll call kernel threads, that the OS like really deals with threads directly. This is not the only model that is out there and has been used. So sometimes we'll have library code deal with threads. So within a process, the kernel will just run the process, and then the library code will have its own scheduler internally. So you'll end up with a hierarchy of schedulers where the kernel will run these processes, or what we'll call, or maybe like macro threads of a process, threads that represent multiple real threads, and the process or those macro threads will schedule individual threads. This is not the model we're going to be talking about, even though it historically was common. It's not currently common, and in fact, several OSs which were using this model just, and things like the Java Virtual Machine, old versions of it used this model, jumped away from it. And probably the biggest reason to not use this model anymore is that it's kind of awkward with multi-core. That with multiple cores, we really want something that knows what needs to use CPU time, deciding how to divide up all the cores, and this is hard to do with this hierarchy of schedulers model. So we're going to assume there's one thread scheduler, and the kernel keeps track of all the threads across all the applications that are running, no matter how many of them are multi-threaded. So since the kernel is keeping track of this, we're going to now split up our process state into thread and process state. So we'll have a thread control block, which has the registers and the state for the scheduler, like is this thread running or not, and so on, versus the process state, like the address space, the open files, process ID, and also presumably a list of the threads that make up the process. So this is the conceptual model we'll talk about, but there's a common thing that some real OSs, notably Linux is a big example, do, which doesn't exactly fit in this model. So Linux has a task structure that represents threads, and it doesn't actually have an explicit process control block. It just has these tasks. Every thread is a task. But the task has pointers to the list of open files and the address spaces. And when we have multiple threads that are part of the same process, the way this is implemented on Linux, each of those threads has a task, and those tasks have the same pointers. So they have the same list of open files, the same address space, but this is not because there's an explicit process control block. This is just because the threads just point to the same thing for that part of the information about the tasks. And this has a certain elegance from the point of view of implementing the OS. So Linux's system call that actually implements fork is this general system call, which called clone. And it takes a list of what things do you want shared after we do this clone of the task. If you specify nothing, it basically behaves like fork. But you can specify, oh, I want to share the open files, or I want to share the memory. And for threads, we'll just specify to share everything we can share. And this is how they provide the ability to create new threads using the same mechanism we started with for forking. Now, if you're thinking about this a little bit, you might think, well, there's a problem with keeping the address space the same, and that now we'll have two threads running using the same stack. And that's not going to work. So an additional thing they have is they let you specify a new stack pointer. But that's like a very small added feature to, you know, the fork call. And change not just the return value, but a stack pointer. So this is a common model. It's not the only model. So Windows uses something probably more conventionally based around having a separate process and thread structures, for example. So this is talking about sort of a very low-level API for manipulating threads. And we are mostly going to be far, far away from that. We're going to talk about the POSIX threading API. And the POSIX threading API is very abstract in comparison to the APIs we've seen. And by that, I mean not that it's not like specifying rather low-level operations, but typically the POSIX threading operations will not correspond directly to a system call like we've seen with fork and so on. They might be implemented in some more complicated way. So we're going to have a way of starting threads. And the POSIX threading API call for this is pthread create. So here I have a program. And when our program starts, it's running one thread. We have to have a thread or else we can't execute code. And so that thread starts by running main. And in this case, we call this pthread create function to run compute py, and again to run print class list, and we have some more code in main. When we run this program, we're going to run main, we're going to execute the first pthread create, and that's going to spawn a thread running the compute py function, and that's just going to keep running. We start it, it gets to run whenever the scheduler decides to run it. And then we create the print class list thread that just runs. It runs whenever the scheduler decides to run it. It might run interleaved or at the same time as the compute py thread and the main thread. Just whatever the scheduler decides to do now that it has a list of three threads it needs to schedule. And the main thread, we have this dot, 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 that will continue executing at the same time concurrently with these two other functions, assuming they're still running. So questions about what goes on, you know, sort of this timeline. I'll talk about what are the arguments to pthread create on the next slide. Okay. So this is our timeline. So we have these calls to pthread create, and I should talk about what are the arguments. So our first argument is a pointer to a thread identifier to fill in. So pthread t is the type before a thread identifier. Because POSIX is trying to be very generic and abstract, they don't tell you if this is an integer or what, but it's some type that you can store. And this fills in the thing you point to with an identifier, and there's some other pthread calls which will take that identifier just like, for example, wait PID took a process ID. So we also have a function to run. So something you might notice about this function is that it returns a pointer to void and takes a pointer to void as an argument. This is required. If you don't want to use that return a pointer to void, sorry, you have to. You don't have to care about the revalue. If you don't want to use an argument, sorry, it's required. You just don't have to care about what's in the argument. This is the only type Pthread supports. They decided to use a pointer to void because that you can convert any pointer to that and use this pretty generically was the idea. There are also these two arguments I've left as null. So the first argument is what's known as thread attributes. So these are extra settings for the threads. Most of the time, you won't care about setting them, but there's information about how you want the thread to start that you specify here. And the last argument is the argument to supply to the function. So in this case, I needed to supply an argument here. I'm just supplying null, but I have to put something there, so that's what I put. If we wanted to pass more information to the thread, and we'll have some examples in a bit, I could pass something other than null there. Questions? Thread create. Okay. So now that we've seen pthread create, let me show you a little piece of code. So here I have a program that uses POSIX threads. I print about to start thread. I create a thread, the thread prints in the thread and then finishes, and then I print done starting thread. And you might say, okay, this is going to vary in maybe the order done starting thread and in the thread get printed, but when I run it, only about 4% of the time does in the thread get printed. So 96% of the time when I ran this, that was not output at all. So what happened? Any ideas? What happened here? Back there?
That it's a separate thread within the same process, so when it returns, if it returns before the message is printed, it'll just like cut all threads.
So you're saying if it, what's it returns?
The main function.
So if the main function returns, you're saying maybe that cuts off all threads, and that's in fact what happens. So the main thread is special. And one way it's special is that returning from main always exits the entire process. That means all its threads. It's equivalent to calling the exit function, and this exits all the threads of the current process. Was this the best choice for POSIX to make? Maybe not, but it's the choice they made. And so we have a race here. We have this print message thread, it gets started, and sometimes main finishes before it can actually print f, sometimes it doesn't. Just depends on how the scheduler works out. And in my environment, 96% of the time, main finished earlier. So questions about this scenario? Yes. So your question is that if main was doing more, we'd expect to see that 4% go up? Yeah, so if we made this blue bar tend to be longer than how much work main has to do, yeah, we tend to see that less and less. So potentially this could be a much worse problem in the sense of, like, if it happened 2% of the time, that would be a lot harder to debug. Like if we had the wrong output 2% of the time, quote unquote. Other questions? Okay. So what's our solution to this? So one solution would be that we could just have, you know, main have an infinite loop at the end. But that's probably not acceptable. We do want the program to terminate, but we want it to somehow wait for the thread to finish. So to do that, we're going to need the equivalent of wait PID. And the equivalent of wait PID is pthread join. So pthread join takes a thread ID. It doesn't take it as a pointer because it just copies the value. It doesn't store a new thread ID. And it also takes a second argument, which is where to put the return value. Here I'm passing null, saying I don't care what the thread returned, just ignore it. But I could pass a pointer to a void star to get the return value of the print message function. So this, like wait PID, will wait for the thread to finish, and this will eliminate our problem with in the thread not terminating, not being printed, because the program terminates too quickly. Questions? This. So there's another way we could avoid this problem, which I do not recommend, but I want to mention exists, that there's a version of xset which only xsets the current thread, called pthreadxset. And you could call that for main. So unlike returning for main, this only xsets the current thread, also unlike calling xset. Don't recommend this, usually not what you want. But yes, there's a way of doing that. And you can think of pthread join is like wait PID, and pthread xset is like xset, but for threads instead of processes. So pthread join is our wait PID, pthread xset is our xset function that just applies to a thread, not a whole process. And I say returns its return value. I mean returns by storing into pointer passed as our second argument. So questions about pthread join and xset? Okay, so now that we have threads, let's try to do something marginally useful. So the example I started with of like computing pi and printing a class list at the same time, pretty contrived. Let's do something slightly less contrived of summing up an array across two threads. So my hope is here I have a very small array, but that I want to split the work of the summing so it's done on two cores. So the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to have one thread sum the first half of the array, and the other thread sum the second half. So I have a function for sum the first half of the array, a function to sum the last half of the array, and I get a partial sum. I'm going to want to add those together eventually. So I store that partial sum in a results array, and then I add that up when I'm done. So my code, sum all here, spawns a thread to sum the first half, spawns a thread to sum the second half, waits for both of those threads to finish, and then adds their two results. And I've elected to say I don't like putting things in void stars for the return value of this, so I'm just returning via a global array. And because these threads are all sharing the same address space, these global variables are shared, which means that when I write into results 0 here, it's available here, even though these are different threads. Okay, so questions? This, yeah. The question is, what happens if both threads write both wrote into result one? And would one overwrite the other? The answer is sometimes. And we'll go into exactly what happens there later. That is going to be a very long and important topic. Any other questions? So when this runs, we can visualize what happens as we have our main thread, presumably calling sum all, and then we have two additional threads we created, and we have these global variables, and this is our memory layout. For the additional threads, they need to have a stack. Can't be the same stack as the main thread, or else we get confused about like what's the return value, what's the return address. That would not work out very well. So we have to have separate stacks, and we're going to create new thread control blocks for each of these threads, where we're going to have a stack pointer in each of them pointing to their stacks. We're going to have the program counter pointing to the two different functions that we're running. So some front and some back in my previous slide. And this is what's going to be happening while they're running. And the code in some front and from back will be accessing the values and results of global arrays. Some questions? So a complaint you might have about the code here is that I have an awful lot of stuff hard-coded. In particular, I have like two versions of the same code with just different numbers. And it'd be really nice not to do that. To have only one version and run just a function that deals with that. Is there a good way I can do that where I don't have to write a front and a back version of my sum function? And maybe something that I can eventually extend to, like, if I had wanted to do it in 4 pieces, or 8 pieces, or 1,000 pieces. So let's talk about a way of having one version of the function. And what we'll do for our one version is we'll pass in whether you're the front half or the back half. And we'll say 0's the front, 1's the back. And we're just going to pass in that number. So we still have our global variables, but we pass in an ID. So I'm passing in this I here, which I'm converting to a pointer just so I can store it. I'm not actually passing a pointer to I. This is the I converted to pointer. This is not a pointer to I. So I'm just taking I and using it as if it were an address. And then I'm undoing that operation immediately at the beginning of this thread. So why am I doing that? Just because I have to take a void star argument. I have to put whatever I want to pass in a void star. This is the most convenient way for me to put an integer in a void star. Okay, so I got this ID, and this loop that calls pthread create gets run with I equals 0. So we pass in a 0 converted to a pointer, we convert it back to an integer, we get 0. Then we pass in 1 converted to a pointer, we convert it back to an integer, we get 1. So I have 1 and 0 in my two different threads that are running this code. Okay. And now, in this way, I can avoid having my two different versions of the function. So questions about what I've done here? Okay, so this is a little unflexible. I've still hard-coded the 512 here, and I've implicitly hard-coded that I'm going to have 2 threads and not 4 or 8, given the size of the array. How can I pass in maybe some more information to make this, you know, be able to handle different numbers more easily? So one thing I can do is instead of passing in one value, I want to pass in a whole bunch of values, like the start and the end location. So I'm going to do that by passing in a struct. So here I have a struct I've defined as my stuff to pass in. And I'm going to have a start and an end location. And also I'm going to change where I store the results. I say, as long as I have this struct, why not have the thread write its result there, instead of figuring out what index into the array, a results array to write it. So it's going to write it just into this struct. So in my thread running function, I have an array of these structs, and I set their start and the end location here, and pass in a pointer to the appropriate element of the array. That gets converted to a void star. We convert it back from a void star to the correct pointer type, and we access that struct and store into the result, into that struct, instead of a global variable. Okay, and in this code, I'm still hard coding that we have two threads and the 512, but now I have one place I can fix that later on and still use the same code in every thread. Questions about what I've done here? So when we run this code, we're going to have two threads with their own stacks, and they're going to have pointers either stored on the stack or in a register in the thread's control block, pointing to the different elements of the info array, which is on the main thread stack. And we still have our values in the, not, we don't have results here anymore, with results as a global variable. Okay, some questions? And we can, you might say, it's kind of unsightly to be using global variables. Can we get rid of that? And now that we're passing a struct, it's actually fairly simple to pass more information to not rely on a global variable anymore. So we can just add to our struct the pointer to the values array and pass that in. And now we don't need to have a global variable to synchronize. We just rely on passing the pointer to the same array, and both of the threads can work on the same array. So this yields this situation, that both of the threads now get a pointer to an element of the info array, and that element of the info array has a pointer to the actual values, as well as all the information about what's your start and end and the place to put the result that we'll read later. Okay, so questions about how this works? So, showing you examples of, so we're starting multiple threads, passing them different information through this, what seemed like a rather unflexible API. And something we can also extend this to is, well, maybe it's not great to be storing it on the main stack. For example, one of the things we often want to do with threads is you want to start a bunch of threads, then do something else, and then wait for the bunch of threads to finish. And we can make a design that makes that possible, but we want to not use local variables to do that. So we can allocate things on the heap. So we can use our same strategy and allocate our thread info data structure array on the heap. We can still pass pointers to things on the heap, just like we did to things on the stack. And in this case, I'm also putting in the thread ID. So I just take that info array and use it later to wait for the threads. Because pthreadt, didn't have to put it in a local variable, can put it anywhere I want. Okay, and now I've split my sumAll function into two functions, so I can call start, the start sumAll, do something else, call finish, and hopefully just get my results. And when this is running, now we have pointers to the heap, which have pointers. Yeah. So I've shown you these examples because you're going to have to write threaded code. And a big question people have is, how do I pass in from something to the thread? How do I make every thread do something different? These are the sorts of patterns that are really common to do that. Even with the POSIX threading API. questions? Okay. So now that we've seen some examples of pthread code, here's some code that is broken. So tell me what's wrong with this. So I'm using the version of pthread join that actually retrieves the result, rather than like passing it through a global variable. What's the problem? Yes? Okay, so you're worried about casting. So that might be a concern. Let's assume this compiles and I have all my casting done. When what returns?
When create string returns, is it going to clean up whatever was at that memory address at that result?
Okay. So you're worried that create string returning might clean up whatever's at that memory address. So which memory address?
Wherever result is stored.
Yeah. So the question is, where is this stored? So where is that stored? This should be a 2150. How does the call stack work question? So where is that stored? On the stack. And that's going to be a problem. Yeah. So. Yeah. And every thread has their own stack. So our string is on one of the new thread stacks. And then we join the thread, and those stacks are deallocated. So now we have a happy pointer that points somewhere over here. We're not going to be able to output it. So, no, we're not even like, this is going to be, since pointer to deallocated memory to dangling pointer, so we had to do something else to return that value. So, what would be an example of a way of fixing this code so it wasn't broken? How do we make create string not have this problem? Yeah.
Make string result global.
So one option for fixing this problem would be that we could say that this string result here should move to as a global. How about another solution? Yeah.
Dynamically allocate the result.
Yeah, so another solution would be to say that instead of returning a pointer to the result, we could say replace this with allocating a new string. That's a copy of the result. And then, in that case, we presumably want to delete that. Afterwards. Okay, so questions? So let's talk about thread resources. So we mentioned that threads have their own stack. So when we're creating a thread, that's going to allocate not only a thread control block, but we have to allocate a new stack for the thread somewhere. And one question you might have, which is a curious question, is like, how big a stack do we make? And we can't really make it huge, because then we can't run many threads. So there's going to be some limit to that. We'll have to choose a size. And we have to deallocate the thread eventually. So the question is, when do we do that? And we're going to have a similar conundrum to what we had with processes. When a process exits, we can deallocate most of the stuff the process was using, but we can't completely get rid of the process until it's been waited for, or else that wait function won't work, right? Wait needs to keep the process around so you can get the exit status. And the same is going to be true for threads, analogously with join, that in order for join to work, we need to remember something about the thread until you join it. So we're not going to completely deallocate the thread until you actually join it. Now, sometimes this is inconvenient, that we don't want to have to join every single thread we create. And the POSIX threading API has an alternative to joining threads known as detaching. So there's a function pthread_detDETACH, and you call it on a thread. It doesn't join the thread. It doesn't wait for it. It just marks it as, don't bother waiting for this thread anymore. I'm not going to do that. Just get rid of it when it finishes. So it says, don't keep it around. I'm not going to join it. I don't care. But keep it running as usual. And if you don't detach or join, then the thread's going to take up resources. And if you keep doing this, you'll run out of resources. Just like if you didn't wait for processes, you'll eventually run out of processes. So this is an alternative to joining, which doesn't wait, but just marks it as, I'm done with this thread. Don't tell me about how it finishes. And don't hold on to it. Now, here I'm creating a thread and then marking it as detached so I don't join it. You can also do this when you create a thread with that attributes argument. So this is an example of a use of that attributes argument where I was passing null to pthread create. I can say, hey, I don't want to join this thread. Just get rid of it when it's done. So another thing the attributes argument does is it lets you specify how big a stack you want the thread to have. So here, for example, I'm saying start the thread with a 32 kilobyte stack. Now you might ask, well, if you don't do this, what size does the stack does it have? And the answer, unfortunately, is it varies a lot. Sorry. It's usually enough for anything you want to do, but it varies a lot. Okay. So one last note on pthread create. The code I'm showing here for pthread create, I just create the thread and keep moving on. And as many of you have encountered with fork in the shell assignment, you know, creating a new process didn't always work. Probably creating a new thread for basically the same reasons won't always work. Sometimes we'll be out of memory or out of thread IDs or something, and it will fail. So you can detect that with pthread create, but it's, the question is, how do you get that? And the pthread functions generally return their error as their return value. So they usually return an int, and that int indicates what error happened. Unlike fork, they don't set error no, they just return the error code. So they return 0 on success. And so 0 is success. And greater than 0 is failure. And which value greater than 0 will be one of these special constants, like here we have E again for out of memory, basically, E and val for you specified attributes that don't make sense, like maybe, like you said, give it a negative stack size, and so on. Now, you should check errors in your pthread create and all the other pthread functions which return an error code. I'm not going to do this on my slides to keep my slides less ugly. This doesn't mean you shouldn't do it on assignments, because it will probably save you time if you figure out that, oh, you're passing something that doesn't make sense to one of these pthread functions by checking the error code and not by trying to debug it for an hour. Questions? So that's on using pthreads API, some basic ways. Now, we're going to talk about actually doing useful things with threads. And in all the examples we've seen so far, I've been having a thread do a task, we wait for the whole thread to finish, and then we get something. But often, we want to do things between threads while threads are running. And this makes problems. And the big issue is that schedulers introduce non-determinism, that the order things run in varies depending on what the scheduler does. And we saw we have all sorts of heuristics and guesses we make in our scheduler. So even on a single core, the order could vary depending on all sorts of little details about what's going on. And with multiple cores, we have even more reasons. Maybe one core is running slower than another, and maybe that happens depending on like the temperature. Like, so things will change all the time. So this allows for race conditions where the outcome will change just randomly, because sometimes one thread will race ahead of another, sometimes it won't. And you'll get different results. And we're going to want to avoid this. So we're going to talk a lot, and I mean a lot, about synchronization constructs, which are all about avoiding these race conditions, about making sure we know what order things happen in, even if one thread is running faster than another because of how the scheduler works out or just your random happenstance. And to give an example of race conditions, I'll start with a classic and arguably contrived example of an ATM server. That we're going to have a server with multiple users and multiple threads. We're going to like have one thread for each user so we can do things at the same time with a withdraw and deposit command. And we have a correctness goal here of not losing money. That seems like that shouldn't be hard. We just need to not do math wrong, and we will lose money. And here's how our ATM server is going to work. We're going to have this loop. We're going to receive a request to deposit or withdraw and execute our deposit or withdraw functions. And we're going to do this with multiple threads. So why would we do this with multiple threads? This is not something that has multiple threads in it. Well, one reason might be that maybe this get account or save account update function is slow, and maybe it's slow because it's like accessing a disk sometimes or accessing a network. And that means that even on a single core, we could be more efficient by running something else that doesn't need to access the disk while it's waiting for the disk, for example. And this would be a reason why maybe we'd run multiple threads all running this loop. You know, just to take advantage of all the available compute time, you know, even though some of the commands are going to be waiting for the disk or waiting for a network. So we'll just have many threads running this server loop. So our code will look like, you know, we choose a number of threads that performs well, and we just execute that many copies of the server loop. But we're going to run into a problem. So let's say two threads are executing our deposit function at the same time on the same account. So we have two deposits to the same account, like, you know, it's a joint account, two people are accessing different ATMs to deposit at the same time, and something bad can happen. And when we look at the C code here, it's not obvious why. Like, this is just a plus equals operation. So what? You have two of them. You know, one of them's going to happen, then the other. But that's not how this operation is going to be implemented in assembly. In assembly, you know, we're going to load the account balance into a temporary register, add to it, and store it. And if we get unlucky, even on a single core, we could load the account balance for one deposit, load it for another, store it for the first deposit, store the modified balance for the first deposit, store it for the second, and now this first deposit goes away. That we wrote a value and then overwrote it, and we've lost that money. Just went away. And this is even though it looks like we just have a plus equals operation, which, you know, that shouldn't matter who does it. But the problem is it's not really a plus equals operation when we go down to a lower level. Questions about this? Yeah. So the question is, why isn't the red the winner of the race? So winner in this case is whoever actually stores a value that gets used. So yes, the winner of the race was the slower thread. Yes. So the question is, doesn't the value of RAX get saved during the context switch? Yes, it does. But each of these threads, we have a thread control block for A, which has its RAX, and a thread control block for B, which has its RAX. And that's where it's saved. So they aren't shared between the two threads. And the code that's just doing the context switch knows nothing about what RAX is being used for, so can't figure out that there's some sort of synchronization you want to do. Can't figure out, this is the time we want to share RAX, even though no other time we wanted to do that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, see, we have our problem here. So let's think about what can happen when we have two threads doing things, quote unquote, at the same time. And we have a model here where, like, you know, we can switch between the threads and that can cause problems because we can do it at the worst possible time. So let's start with this simple example. I have thread A. For all these examples, I'm going to have two variables, x and y, that store numbers. And I'm saying thread A writes 1 to x, thread B writes 2 to y. What's going to be the value of x after we do this? What are all the possibilities for x? This is not a trick question. Well, arguably a trick question, but there's nothing tricky about the answer. This is like the simple one, warm-up problem. It's not meant to be hard. Someone tell me, yeah. One's the only possibility because we're going to assume that hopefully, even if we execute that assignment to y at any sort of overlapping with the assignment to x, it won't interfere. That's our hope. That at least is true. If that's not true, it's going to be really hard to use threads. Note that this has some implications, like probably we like can't store x and y like in the same byte, or else this might actually be a problem. So how about this example? So what's the value of x? Thread A is taking the value y, which is initially 0, adding 1 to it and storing an x, and thread B is doing some calculations with y. So give me any possible value of x? Yeah. 1? Okay. So how did you get 1?
Before the y is the 2 is sort of 1.
Yeah, so you said 1 would be there. Okay, how about another? Yeah.
3?
How did you get 3?
Like after 2 gets moved into y.
Okay, so just write, it gets right there. Any others? Yeah. 5. So, and 5, where we run this line here. So we have all these different interleavings with different results. And this is a very simple example. You can see that with more complete examples, this can get, like, we can get a whole lot of possibilities. Okay. So those are results I have. So how about this example? We have thread A is assigning 1 to x. And thread B is assigning 2 to x. So what possibilities can we think of here? Give me one possibility. Yeah.
1.
Okay. And that's if what happens?
Thread A gets run.
Thread A gets run last. Okay. Any other possibilities? Yeah. 2. And how do you get that? And two, you say thread A runs before three. How about any others? So you're saying one or two are what you get, but I have a question. Like, you're making an assumption here about how we write to x. So why don't we get three? Maybe we write bit 0 of x in B, then we write bit 0 and of x in A, and we write bit 1 of x in A, and then we write bit 1 of x in B. So we get three. Why isn't that possible? And you're thinking, well, of course we wouldn't do that. So you have some implicit assumptions. And we're going to want to make some assumptions like this, but we'll need to be explicit about, like, when can we assume this sort of thing isn't happening? Because otherwise, like, our possibilities explode. Like, for our other example, we could get 7. Because A could read the value y is while B is changing it from 2 to 4 and get some mix between 2 and 4 of 6, for example. So in order to reason about how multiple threads behave, we're going to want to assume that things like this aren't actually possible. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to define some things as atomic operations. These are things which complete all at once, you know, or not at all, that we never observe an atomic operation that's half done. It's already always fully done or not done. We can never look at it and see an in-between state, like I've written the bottom bit of x, but not the the second to last bit, which created that 3 scenario. And this will help us figure out when threads can work together. And one atomic operation that pretty much all of you probably intuitively thought was atomic is loading or storing what I'll call words, like natural size values, like things that fit in a register on machines. And in most machines, loading or storing words is atomic, which is very nice because otherwise it'd be a lot harder to figure out what goes on. And you might say, well, then all instructions are atomic. And if we were thinking about the case where we have a single core and we're context switching, yes, because we can only context switch after an instruction completes. But with multiple cores, this doesn't quite work. Some instructions are going to be executed by the hardware in multiple steps. And another core can see something while the hardware is in the middle of executing the instruction. So one example of this, which I'll show you shortly, is that x86 has an instruction that adds a constant to a memory location. This is a rather complicated instruction to implement in the hardware because we're reading and writing a memory location. And on a typical x86 processor, it's implemented with multiple steps such that you can observe from another thread on another core some in-between results, even though it's a single instruction. Another common example of something which requires multiple steps is loading or storing values that cross cache blocks. So values which are what we call aligned, where their address doesn't cross a cache block boundary, it's a multiple of the value size, we can store in one operation. But if it crosses cache blocks, or then we have to spend multiple commands to read or write it, and this means that often those instructions will not be atomic, that on another core you could see half of the store done because we have to do it in two pieces. So let's look at, you know, this, what happens for this example of the integer add to a memory location. So here I have some assembly code, and here's my add instruction. This adds 1 to a global variable. The global variable is stored in memory. This is an add 1 to a value in memory instruction. And I have a loop which executes this a number of times that's specified by the argument. I'm passing in an argument of 1,000,000 and running 2 threads that are running the same loop. And I ran this on my desktop where I have multiple cores. And if this instruction, this add instruction was atomic, you'd expect to get a result around 2 million. But because it's executed in multiple steps, it's going to be possible for us to have that lost write problem, even though this is one instruction. That because the hardware is splitting it up into pieces, the hardware can get a version of the lost write with those pieces. So questions about this problem setup I have here, what I'm doing. So I'm running one thread, two threads that are both incrementing a global variable, the value, a million times. But they're using one instruction to do that, but that instruction is not actually atomic. It doesn't actually happen all at once. So I ran this many, many times, and I got a histogram of what values I got out. And here's that histogram. So I have two threads incrementing a value a million times. So our expected value is about 2 million. This is the range of values I got out. So in fact, I even got values that were less than a million. So this is something which is only possible because of multiple cores, clearly. And it has to do with the processor implementing this instruction with multiple steps, which can happen in various orders and cause these really confusing results. Okay, so questions? This example. So given this, you might say, so I mentioned, what's atomic? How do I know? So we're going to assume loading or storing words is atomic for now, even though, as we'll learn, that is maybe less true than we would like. And our rule for is that if you want something to be atomic, the processor designer better tell you it is. If they don't tell you it's atomic, you should assume it's not. And they're going to tell you it's atomic because they're going to design caches and other components of the processor to make that happen. And that's their job as a processor designer, is to figure out that for whatever they want to tell you is atomic or isn't. And hopefully, they're going to give you enough things which are atomic that you can write threaded code that does something useful. Okay. So I'm going to start by looking at, well, we have loads and stores of words. Is that going to be enough to handle coordinating multiple threads? Like I saw, we ran into problems with the bank account scenario, but maybe we could be more clever and have avoided that. And to talk about this, I'm going to use an analogy to sort of a real-life synchronization problem. And that problem is going to be, let's say we have roommates, Alice and Bob, and they want to keep their fridge stocked with milk. And they have this problem that, you know, if they don't coordinate, then they can buy more milk than they want to. Because Alice looks, there's no milk, she decides, okay, I'm going to go out and buy some milk. Bob comes home when Alice is buying milk and buys his own milk, and they end up with twice as much milk as they wanted. So they'd like to coordinate to avoid this. And we can think of a solution to this. So what's a solution that we can use as humans that avoids this problem? Yeah.
Alice tells Bob she's getting milk.
So yeah, Alice just needs a way to tell Bob. So we're going to say that Alice can leave a note. And we're going to tie our idea of a note to this load and store by saying a note is storing a value. Reading the note is loading the value. So it's the same kind of operation that we know we can have be actually atomic. So this would be something that we could get sensible results between multiple threads. So my proposal here is Alice leaves a note saying, I'm buying the milk. Okay. And places it before she buys the milk, removes it after she buys the milk, and checks for a note, if note's there already, from Bob saying, I'm buying the milk, and doesn't buy milk in that case. And
And this we can do with our atomic load and store. We write like one to represent there's a note. Someone says, I'm buying the milk, and zero to say there's no note. And we load that note to see there is. So our logic is, if there's no milk, check if there's a note. If there's no note, leave a note, buy some milk, and move on. So here's our like computer code version of this, but like many things with computers, like when we write down the instructions this exactly, because our computers are being perhaps more literal than we expected, this doesn't work the way we want. So what's the problem? Why does this computer code version of it not work? What can go wrong? So we're assuming Alice does this, and Bob's going to do the same thing, right? Because Bob also wants to buy some milk, but not if Alice is already doing so. Yeah. So if they both leave notes at the same time, yes. So what can happen is Alice checks if there's no milk and no note, finds out, yes, there is. And while she's preparing her note, Bob checks if there's no milk and finds there's no note yet. And so Alice leaves a note, buys some milk, and you know Bob gets distracted for a bit, but he remembers there wasn't a note, then he leaves a note and buys some milk, and now we still have too much milk. And this is a scenario where we get in trouble for how computers work, because you know that probably Alice and Bob would meet at some point and figure out something's wrong, but that's not how threads in our computer programs are going to work unless we add some code to do that. So we're still in trouble. Okay, so questions? So you might say, well, the problem here is that we're not using the note for the right part of the operation, that we should just leave a note before we even check if there's milk. You know, say, hey, I'm either buying some milk or checking if there's enough milk right now. That'll solve the problem. So here's our proposed algorithm. Does this work? So there's a trivial reason why it doesn't work. Yeah. What? You'll never go to buy milk. The problem is there is always a note because you just left one. So the solution to this problem is intuitive. You should leave notes with names. Have like a separate, so let's say a separate variable for notes from Alice and notes from Bob. So here's a better looking solution. So Alice leaves a note from Alice and checks for a note from Bob. Bob leaves a note from Bob, checks for a note from Alice. So in this case, at least we're not being confused in that. And because we check for a note before we check for milk, or start buying, we don't have that problem of getting distracted after we check for a note and getting confused. But if we get distracted, we at least know no one's buying milk while we're distracted. But this still doesn't work. So what's the problem here? So this does avoid buying too much milk, but we've introduced a new problem. Yeah. Yeah, so it's possible that if they're leaving a note at the same time, they'll both see each other's note and decide not to buy milk. So we've avoided them buying too much milk, problem solved, but now we're being too paranoid about not buying milk, so sometimes we just won't, because they'll look at each other and say, yep, you must be checking for milk, and you must be, and assume everything's fine. Which kind of is analogous to things which could really happen without notes. You know, that you both assume, yep, they must have checked for milk. They're going to do it. But we still run into problems. So you might say, gosh, this is very tricky. Is there a solution? And yes, there is. There's a solution that only involves this reading and writing notes. It's just not very elegant. It's really not very elegant. Here's the solution. And The thing that you probably find most inelegant about this is that Alice and Bob need to do different things. Like, you really wanted it to be nice and symmetric? Sorry, it's not. So Alice leaves a note and waits for Bob to leave a note. Waits for Bob to not have a note be left, and then checks, and Bob leaves a note, and if there's no note for Alice right now, buys milk. So this is, I assert, correct. I'm not going to prove it. It's, in fact, hard to prove. There's lots of cases. You could probably do it. It's just really tedious and really tricky. And, well, I have a solution here. What about if I have, you know, more than two people? What if we have three roommates? You know, Alice, Bob, and Carol. Well, how do we extend this? That is not obvious at all. So, if you want to actually do this, this is an example of what's known as Peterson's algorithm. So Wikipedia like has the work, and we're not going to use it. This is way too complicated, but what this shows us is that, yes, we can coordinate our threads with atomic loads and stores, that if reading and writing from memory, you know, works the way we expect, that is sufficient to coordinate between our threads, but boy, is it inconvenient. Boy, it is really inconvenient. So we're going to have special hardware support instead. Because it's so inconvenient, we want something that is actually, you know, kind of useful. So we're going to talk about an abstraction that we're going to implement with that special hardware support. Next time, I will talk about exactly what the form of the hardware support is. But first, I'm going to talk about the abstraction, which is going to be a lock. And so some definitions. What we want to provide in this milk example is that one person checks for and buys milk at the same time. And this is going to be an example of what we'll call mutual exclusion, that there's some operation that we want exactly one thread to do at a time. In this case, it was checking for and buying milk. For our bank account example, it's reading and adding to the bank account balance. We want exactly one thread to do that at once. And we'll call the code that can be executed by exactly one thread at a time a critical section, which is a little capture. And we'll have this abstraction that we use to implement mutual exclusion and turn code into critical sections called a lock. And the abstraction of a lock is an object that you can have locked for yourself, but only one thread can do it at a time. So this is our interface for creating critical sections. Okay, some questions about these definitions. Okay, so locks are going to have two operations. One's going to be called acquire or lock. The other's going to be called release or unlock. The acquire operation waits until the lock is free and then gets it for the current thread. And the release operation makes the lock that was previously not free and frees it up so another thread can use it. So one thread can have the lock at a time. They call acquire to wait for the lock. When acquire finishes, they have the lock. You know, so you get the lock, do your operation, unlock the lock. And we saw this in the scheduler code in XP6. This is what that implements, that one at a time interface. Okay, some questions? Other definitions? So I have this sort of abstract view. I've used the lock and unlock names instead of acquire and release here, because that's what pthreads uses. So pthread has a lock called a mutex. This is the interface for it. So there's a lock operation, an unlock operation, and before you use it, you need to call this init function to set it up. And you take some parameters about how you want to set it up. And XP6 also has locks called spin locks, which have an acquire and release operation we've already seen, and you have to initialize them. in some code that runs typically at boot, like that example there. So questions, lock APIs. Okay. So that's where I'll leave off for today.